Hey, everybody. Welcome to This Week in 1920s Baseball. This is your co-host, Josh, a.k.a. Bucketfoot. I got Sweet Bread Matthew on the line. How you doing, Sweet Bread?
Oh, good morning. How are you doing, Josh? Bucketfoot?
Doing great, man. I'm glad we're getting a little bit back into recording here after a hiatus. Once I dive back into it, I just keep finding interesting things. There's just so many fun things to uncover. So what we're doing today, listeners, is we each decided, this is like, you know, off-season kind of programming, rather than following the day's headlines, we're going to pick some just interesting topics. And so what we decided today to do is to each pick a player, one specific player who played in the 1920 season. And we found them interesting, but they're probably not well known to either the other one of us or to the general listener. I didn't tell Matthew who I picked. He didn't tell me. And we're going to see if we can like blow each other's minds with these cool.
Hopefully we didn't pick the same person, but you know.
You know, it did cross my mind that we might. I'll tell you who I was thinking about doing. Turkey Stearns.
You know, that's amazing because I actually was thinking about doing him. I was thinking about doing him.
I think I was like, if I picked Turkey Stearns, Sweetbread probably also did. That's funny because his name has just come up a couple times lately, and his name is Turkey Stearns.
Yeah, he came up in our NAR episode and a couple of times this season.
Sean Gibson talked about him
in the Ballpark Dimensions podcast.
They talked about him
podcast that we both love. So, yeah, I had the same thought. And I think, and I could be wrong, because he really started to come into his own a little bit later. And I think that might have been one of the reasons I didn't pick him.
Okay. I don't know too much about him
because I was like, oh, man, Josh is going to pick somebody like that. So,
Turkey Stearns. We'll have to, maybe we'll combine our research skills and we'll just do a full Turkey Stearns deep dive.
Yeah, maybe like around Thanksgiving next year.
We'll have a turkey day. That is a good idea. Do you want to tell me who you did pick? Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Whatever you want. Okay, that sounds good.
I'll tee you up.
So I was looking for somebody kind of, you know, that wasn't as well known. And, you know, all the discussion that we've had recently about the Negro Leagues and the stats being included in the baseball encyclopedia, I was kind of poking around. So the player that I picked is actually a Cuban ball player. By the name of Cristobal Torriente. And of course, as all of you probably know, that, you know, Cuban Latin players at the time were also excluded, de facto excluded from the majors.
Cristobal Torriente.
Cristobal Torriente.
I have heard the name. I mean, because I know when we first looked at the 1920 Negro National League, I mean, his name jumps out at you. I mean, obviously, for being a Spanish.
He's got a great name, and his name jumps out because he played on the Chicago American Giants, of course, Rube Foster's team. And, he's a Latin player, so he kind of jumps out. His name jumps out.
So he was good because Rube somehow ended up with all the best players.
Yeah, and he's also a Hall of Famer. Yes. He's 2006 inductee into the Hall of Fame.
I think all but the absolutely most fanatical baseball fans would be surprised to know that there's a Cuban-born star from the 20s named Cristobal Torriente who is in the Hall of Fame. I mean, no one has heard of this guy.
So let me give you a little bit of his career. Sure. Yeah, and then we can kind of discuss maybe a few of the controversies because his, like a lot of the players from this era, from the Negro Leagues, there's just not a lot of information, unfortunately. And there's not a lot of information from basically from when he retired to his unfortunate early death in 1938. So Cristobal was born in Cienfuegos, and I'm mispronouncing it, I apologize, Cuba in 1893.
Oh, that's right.
And unfortunately died at 44 in a poor hospital in New York City in 1938.
That's very young.
Yeah, so Torriente, unfortunately, according to the reports, was a bit of a partier and an alcoholic. But again, there's just not enough information about that to make that kind of bold statement. But according to the general consensus, he also had, and then he died of tuberculosis, which is supposedly confirmed both by his death certificate, but also, well, we'll get into this later, some forensic evidence surrounding his remains.
I say 44 is very young because that's how old I am.
You're young, Josh.
Oh, so young.
We both agree. Yes, we're still in the flower of our youth here.
So young.
Yeah. So, what was I saying? So, he came up, in 1912, he was, I think, like 19. He came up into the kind of the top Negro leagues in America. And he, again, a lot of the players at the time are playing, with multiple teams that are playing year round, and the stats are really sparse. Again, the stats that we were talked about last time that are being officially recognized only start in 1920, I think, from 1920 to 48. So I mean, even though there are some stats out there, they're not recognized still, which we can get into discussion about whether or not we like that or not, because they're kind of like saying, okay, only these stats count and these don't. And it's, I don't know, is it better? Is it worse? Or he was signed, really became kind of a star after 1918 when he was signed by the Chicago American Giants, Rube Foster's Giants. In 1920 through 22, he hit like 380, 400, 360 or something those 3 years. I can actually pull it up. So in 1920, he hit 417. And, so he had a 1.125 OPS that year.
He led the league, right? He, in that National League, he was the best hitter of the year, I think.
I think probably, yeah. And then would go on to hit, 321 the next year. It's weird. They don't have like a career batting average, I've noticed, on Baseball Reference for some of these players.
The best site for Negro League stats is Seamheads.
Oh, that's right.
Seamheads is awesome. I'm looking at it right now. It lists his career batting average at 343, which is really phenomenal.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
176 OPS plus. So he was really exceptional for his time. So he stole some bases. He has
a lot of triples, doubles, steals. Just a really all around player. He hit lefty, hit left and threw left. He was an outfielder. So Torriente, his kind of claim to fame, so to speak, was, or the thing that kind of stands out in terms of the mythic baseball past, is the 1920 barnstorming series between the Havana Reds and the New York Giants, the New York baseball Giants. So this was November of 1920. There was a 9-game series, and Babe Ruth was invited to join the Giants. So Babe Ruth and guys like Frankie Frisch were down in Havana, and they played the Havana Reds that I guess Torriente was playing with at the time, or during the winter season. And it was a 9-game series, and I don't have like the win-loss in terms of the two teams, but apparently the Havana Reds dominated the New York Giants at the time, and there was a lot of stuff written about it. And Torriente had an incredible series. He actually, it goes back and forth whether or not he hit home run off of Ruth. Ruth came in relief the one game. Supposedly he didn't, but people go back and forth about it. And one of the articles that I read about by somebody on Sabre was talking about how a lot of the achievements from this series, this 9-game series, 1920, were kind of overblown for a couple of reasons, which makes sense. That apparently the Giants were kind of just there to party and go out in Havana and in the famous nightlife in Havana, and especially Ruth himself, and were not really necessarily thinking of it as a competitive series. Now I don't know if I necessarily agree with that per se, but there's something to be said for that. So the idea was that maybe they weren't necessarily giving it their all, or they just weren't in good physical shape after a night of revelry.
right.
We all know about Ruth's exploits. So that's been written out by a writer called John Holloway, that series and Torriente in general, and that's Black Ball Stars. Listeners, give that a Google, check that out. I'm sure me and Josh will check that out at some point. Sounds like a really interesting series of writing about the Negro Leagues. And so, you know, kind of flashing forward in Torriente's career, he has a great 1920s in terms of his stats. But by the end of the decade, he's been basically out of baseball just about. And again, some of the reports are is because he was such a partier. And again, we don't know exactly, you know, what happened. But and then unfortunately, you know, he pretty much passes away penniless in 1938 in New York City of tuberculosis that he had, again, according to these forensic studies, if it is his body that they found in Cuba, had suffered from tuberculosis for a number of years. So, okay, so basically the controversy today is where he's buried, because a lot of the Cuban baseball enthusiasts really want to remember their Cuban players in history, and they have this great nonprofit that they started a few years ago, as well as this big memorial in Havana to famous Cuban players. So in 2017, the death certificate of Torriente says he's buried in Queens in a mass grave, and but in Cuba they found this box with his name on it with remains, and again you can Google this. It's called "Where Is Torriente?" It's on YouTube, and that's put together by this. And I apologize, I don't have the name of the nonprofit organization. But basically, they did a whole forensic analysis of this skeleton, and they came to the conclusion that they cannot be for sure that it's Torriente, but that it was highly likely that it was.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. So right now there's some controversy, and if you look at his baseball reference page, it still says, well, I don't even know why it says the Bronx on that, which is completely inaccurate on both ends. Cemetery, Bronx, New York. But it's whether or not he's buried in a mass grave still in Queens, or his body was exhumed and brought to Havana, Cuba, to Colon Cemetery. So I won't spoil the whole story. I guess I kind of did, but you could look up "Where Is Torriente?" It's especially the second half of the video really goes into the forensic analysis of the remains. It's really interesting stuff. Whether or not it was Torriente that the bones belong to.
I'm going to put it on our Twitter too. I've been using our Twitter a little more. So 1920s baseball on Twitter. I'll post a link to the "Where's Torriente" video.
People awesome. Can check that out.
Do you, this might be like putting you on the spot, but like, do you know where he sort of like ranks among great Cuban ball players? Are there others from that era that reached his heights, or does he sort of stand out as like the best Cuban star in the American Negro Leagues, you think?
I think at that time, most likely. But again, I don't know enough, unfortunately. You know, that would be something to ask maybe some of our Cuban friends that really understand the history. The video does talk about like the kind of the father of Cuban baseball, his name as well, unfortunately. You know, obviously some of these articles are talking about, you know, how valid the stat projections are for some of these players. And of course, we've had a lot of really great Cuban ball players recently as well. So in terms of all time, I don't know. But at that time, yeah, I think it's a good assumption that he was one of the best, if not the best. I mean, he was playing on the Chicago American Giants, who were, I think, the premier team kind of before the Monarchs, right? So
yeah, when you look at that Negro National League, we looked at the opening day rosters of the 1920 teams. I would say there's a handful of Spanish names, not, you know, to try to guess where they're all from, but I think a number of them were Cuban. But of anyone in that league, he was one of the best hitters. So yeah. That's pretty cool that he is, he was such a successful player and such a unusual time and such like a sort of forgotten star. So that was a good find.
Thank you. Yeah. So now I'm really curious to who you picked.
Well, I picked a guy you might have heard. I might have mentioned him once or twice in passing. He's a guy who was not a great player. He played for 9 years. He had a total career WAR of 2.8. And most of that was in 1 year. He had a good 1916. He hit .264 and slugged .333, which is obviously not a remarkable year, but that was his best year. So almost all of his WAR was accumulated in that 1 year. He had 2 career home runs. And so most of his career, he was right around zero or slightly below zero for his WAR. So, you know, this is not a guy who's going to be in the Hall of Fame. So why are we talking about him? His WAR was not impressive, but his NAR is very impressive.
I knew it.
You knew it? You knew I went with the NAR. NAR is nickname above replacement. And this is another thing we haven't discussed. What if a guy had so many, more than one nickname? Like, is NAR cumulative in that way? Like, can a guy have multiple cool nicknames?
And does that? I feel that like if that, I feel like you would go, if you were ranking the overall NAR, my gut feeling on this, if you're ranking the overall NAR, you would go with one name. But if you needed a tiebreaker or something to push you over the edge,
okay,
the fact that they had multiple would definitely be, I think, a big push in that direction.
So if you look at his Sabre page, it lists all these various nicknames. Chess, Chubby Chester, Chatterer Chet, Tom, Tommy, the Golden West Receiver, the Kansan, the Baseball Populist, and Goat. And finally, his nickname that he's most known as was Pinch. So this dude's name is Pinch Thomas. Have I mentioned him to you before?
That sounds somewhat familiar.
It's a good name. Pinch Thomas is a good name. And all those other names are pretty good. I mean, no one's calling him like the Baseball Populist as like a just friendly nickname in the dugout, but this is pretty good. Or the Golden West Receiver. So as you can guess from that, he was a catcher. Pinch Thomas was a catcher. And he really was kind of like a utility catcher, a backup catcher, not a, you know, superstar dude. But, you know, the name definitely caught my eye. And then also, his career really was kind of interesting. He was really known for his off-the-field exploits, so I'll get into that momentarily. But he did have some memorable moments on the field. He had 4 World Series rings. So we're talking about a guy who played for 9 years.
Girardi type. Yeah, he was a winner, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he was like Girardi. He won 4 World Series rings in 9 years with a WAR of just 2. I feel like there's some sort of equation there that could be worked out to determine like who's the worst player with the most World Series rings. And like it might be him because his WAR was just about 0, but he always ended up winning. He was part of the Red Sox teams of the 1910s, which I know we talked about a little bit because as we began our 20 season, the Red Sox obviously had sold Ruth and were starting their, less successful period. But I didn't realize exactly how good the Red Sox were in the 1910s. They really dominated the decade. They won, they won the World Series 4 times. The Red Sox did in 1912, 1915, 1916, and 1918. Thomas wasn't there in 1918 because he got traded prior to that. But where he ended up was with the Indians, who of course won the series in 1920. So that was his next ring. He actually got traded to the A's from the Red Sox, who were like the Red Sox were they were so good and the A's were terrible. And Thomas loved being part of the Red Sox. He was good friends with Ruth. He was like living the high life, winning rings, and he was so mad to have to go play for Connie Mack, who was like kind of nasty, and the A's were just terrible. And he actually, I don't know if he like held out or he just like threw a stink, but before he ever played a game with the A's, they ended up trading him to the Indians. So he had an extra trade, but he didn't ever spend time in an A's uniform. So he came to the Indians in 1920, but going back to his time with the Sox, he was part of the game, the famous game in 1917, where Babe Ruth was thrown out so this is Babe Ruth, the pitcher, was kicked out of the game after one batter. So Ruth walked the first guy. You've probably heard this story, right?
Now that I'm looking at it, it looks very familiar.
Yeah, so Babe Ruth walked the first batter in a game and did not like the call, argued with the umpire, and got ejected. And so did his catcher. His catcher was Pinch Thomas. Pinch and Babe were just going at the ump after one batter, and they both got removed from the game. So they brought in replacement catcher, obviously. They bought in a replacement pitcher, Ernie Shore. The guy who was on first got caught stealing, and then Shore retired the next 26 batters in a row. So it's one of these, like, super odd no-hitters. Technically, Babe Ruth gets credited with a partial no-hitter. All he did was walk a guy, and then he left. And now, then
I had heard, and this is, like, completely, like, a just, like, an anecdote, but I had heard that Ruth had wanted to get to the bar early that day or something, and, like, had purposely gotten thrown out. Now, again, this is just some old baseball tale, but I thought that was pretty funny.
And that sounds like something that Pinch would have been part of, that they would have both gotten thrown out to go drink together. Cause he was Ruth's drinking buddy. That was like, that persisted throughout their career. So Pinch was like, they were friends. Their wives were friends. They like went golfing together. They traveled together and stuff. So he was really Babe Ruth's buddy. So I could see the two of them definitely hatching a plan to get thrown out together. I mean, cause how bad was that call? How bad was that call for the first batter of the game to get ejected? You got to give the ump at least one to settle in. I mean, you could maybe bark at him, but to get tossed, you are looking for trouble. That maybe that's why the story, or maybe it's true. It that's funny, but that's one of the oddest no hitters of all time for sure. And it almost, you know, people debate if Shore should get credit for the no hitter or for a perfect game, because he picked the guy off, or I guess the catcher did. The guy got caught stealing, and then he retired the next 26. So Thomas was winning these lots of rings. He was part of the very famous game. Very average player himself, but off the field is when he really would shine. He was not huge. He was 5'9", 170 something, which is like, I don't know if that was probably average height for the time, but like he you know, players were smaller for a little bit for sure than they are now. But he was a scrapper, and he was a loudmouth, and he was getting in fights all the time. There's one story about him when he was young, a young ball player. He was at a, this is just such like a 1920 story. He was like, he was bragging to this other guy. His last name is spelled M-I-T-Z-E, Mites, maybe Carl Mites. So they were out at the bar, and Pinch is bragging and talking about how many big hits he got the night before. This is when they were coming up. And Mitz, I guess, hadn't had a big game. And then Pinch was like, yeah, Mitzi, where's your big hits? And Mitz, this is a quote, said, I'm there with a big wallop, all right. And then he punched Pinch Thomas in the face. So that is just such a good 1920s baseball story. I'm there with the big wallop, all right. And then he got in a fight. It said his career was almost ended because he was beaten by a gang of street thugs. He was temporarily blinded in one eye. They thought his career was over, but he came back from that. He was always getting fights. He was always drinking. He was always causing a ruckus. And they found a good place for him on the field, which was as a third base coach. The kind of neat thing is, like, at the time, a lot of times backup players in particular would be used as coaches when they weren't playing. So they used him as a third base coach. And he was just known for just annoying the other team so much. He would just make a pest of himself. There's another quote that says, Chet keeps up streams of verbal harassment that drove opposing pitchers off the mound and knocked fielders off kilter. So opponents and umpires hated him. But he did, his teammates loved him, and he did, he felt like, you know, he would just do whatever it took to win. So even if he wasn't a star, he was going to find a way to help the team win. And part of that was being on third base coach. So that's where his nickname Chatterer Chet came from, is that he would just like jump around there in the third base box and yell at everybody.
The rough and tumble of the early baseball. You know what we should do? We should find like the greatest brawler in baseball history. Or like at the time, you know.
Well, here's another good story about a fight that he got into. He fought with this player named Jimmy Austin during a game. So Austin was at bat. The pitcher was throwing inside, and Austin was complaining. And so Pinch said something to the effect of, just get back in there and strike out and go sit down. Just get it over with. Stop your griping. Just take your cuts and go sit down. You're going to strike out anyway. So then Austin turned around and punched Chet in the face. So they're having a brawl right there at the home plate. The umpire stepped in between the two of them, and then Austin punched the umpire in the face. And they claims it was unintentional, but it was a full-on brawl. And they both got, you know, some punishment from the league. But the Red Sox president, whose name was James Lannon, he was quoted coming to Pinch's defense. And he said, had Thomas not gone after Austin, I would have fined him for his lack of aggression. So he was like, not only am I not mad that he decked him, I'm glad that he did, and I would have fined him had he not. So you're getting the picture. Fiery guy, knack for being on winning teams, not much of a player, but a real character. And he got into the headlines for the next thing is like, which just caught my eye. He eloped with a cabaret dancer named Doxie Emerson Love. So her last name is Emerson-Love. Her first name is Doxie. Doxie Emerson Love. I couldn't find anything else about her, but apparently she was kind of a famous cabaret dancer at the time. Pinch married her like in an elopement, ran off with her, made kind of a big buzz at the time. Even when he ended up on not being Babe's teammate anymore, they remained friends together. Like I said, they travel and drink together and party and stuff. He left baseball in 1921. He was still like relatively young, but he got involved with the movie industry somehow. And so he moved to Hollywood to make films. And he was like, said he was usually credited as an assistant director. So whatever that means, I mean, I know what an assistant director is, but like in that context, I don't know what exactly his role was in the movies. But in the 1920s, 1921 was his last year in baseball. And then he died fairly young at 65 with a variety of health ailments. But man, did he live a colorful life with a great nickname, a great 1920s and 1910s party dude, old Chubby Chester, Chattering Chet, the Golden West receiver, Pinch Thomas. I think that he was known as being a pinch hitter. Like that's mostly what he did. So that's probably where that nickname came from. But there quite possibly could be some other funny story about it.
That's great. Yeah. It looks like who knows? Looks like he had a pretty good stats as a pinch hitter. Boston, there was something there, but
yeah, they found a good role for him.
Brought him up. Cause I mean, when has anybody ever really talked about Pinch in the last 50 years? Who knows? I mean, maybe somebody has, but I don't think so.
Yeah. I'm gonna read you one article that I found. It's mentioned in passing. It's not really about him at all. But I just want to read it because the writing is so good. It's from a story from a game that I think we did cover because it was part of the Indians-Yankees series in the summer of 1920. First of all, like the headlines make me laugh because this story just literally has six headlines, and like baseball was just such big news. So the first head is Yankees downed by Indians 5-4. And then it says, crowd of 20,000 sees speakers men take opener of series for leadership. And then the third headline is Caldwell excels Quinn. And then the next headline, winning streak of New York veteran is broken after he runs up 8 victories. And then the fifth headline, it says Hugmen lack alertness. So remember the Hugmen are the Yankees because of Miller Huggins, the manager. And then the final headline is errors of judgment and an important factor in reverse by their leading pennant rivals. So the writing is just so good. It says the Indians set right out to tomahawk Quinn in the first. Jameson shot a single just out of Peck's reach, and he went to third on Chapman's single to right. Speaker signaled to left and scored Jameson. Chapman tried to sneak to third on the play, but he was out. Lewis to Musial. Chet Thomas, coaching a third, kicked so earnestly at the decision that Billy Evans benched him. So Chet makes the story for getting kicked out as the third base coach, arguing whether or not Chapman was safe at third. Amid a deafening chorus of booing, Ruth smashed a popper at Wamby, who fumbled the ball and then made a wild toss to Chapman for a forced play. The ball rolled over the left field line, Musial scoring, and Ruth was anchored at third. Pratt jammed a single to center, and Ruth romped over with the tying tally. I just love the writing. Two of the Indians were subdued in the sixth when Doc Johnson cudgeled a healthy three-bagger to the center field stockade. Doc tried to score on the play, but a fine relay, Bodie to Lewis to Hannah, caught Johnson at the plate by 10 feet. Doc jumped into Hannah and spiked him on the little toe. This occasioned a big fuss, during which kindly hands restrained Hannah from having a reckoning with Johnston. There were no casualties. That's how the article ends.
What an
That's great, right?
So great.
I think that Hannah's nickname was Truck, by the way. I think Truck Hannah is that guy that they're referring to. So that was a good nickname too. And so, yep, our man Pinch Thomas makes the article, even though he was a reserve player, just by getting himself ejected from the game while yelling at the umpire. So classic 1920s baseball writing, classic 1920 baseball character, the great Pinch Thomas, the baseball populist.
Well, thanks, Josh. Loved it. Yeah, it was a great little anecdotes about him.
It's amazing. Very, very colorful.
Everybody we seem to look into, it seems to have so much personality and
things. Yes. Anywhere you look, you just find these interesting things. I found this other like funny article where like it's just surprising to me that this kind of article was written in 1920. It was just the journalist was just going through the whatever directory of players, I think he calls it. Essentially, it's just like the list, like the list of all the rosters, and just counting up how many guys have the same name. He just found this like amusing, I guess. And so the headline is Smiths in the van. 8 of them in 2 major leagues. Only 3 Millers remain. In the van.
The Smith-Miller rivalry of
time. Yes. Smiths in the van? Like, does that mean they're in the lead? But it mentions Pinch. That's why I found this article. But yeah, the whole article is really funny. There's a list of all the Smiths. It mentions Zach Wheat and Mac Wheat.
Mm. There we go. They made the episode.
Yeah, there they are. Yeah, the Smiths, there were a lot of Smiths out there. They debate whether or not Walter Schmidt should count, smell, you know, that's like a different name, but similar enough, I guess, the German spelling of Smith. So there was one other little, they mentioned Cy Williams in here. The Williams family is represented by Cy, the slugging outfielder of the Phillies, Claude, the star southpaw of the White Sox, and Kenneth, an outfielder with the St. Louis. There were a bunch of guys named George Burns, like at least 2, which is funny. Yeah. So, and there were several Thomases. So that's why Pinch mentioned these articles mentioned in here. So his choice for the oddest name in the majors, this writer from 1920, was either Peckinpah or Pisinich. Those were his choices.
Mm.
Yeah. This is like a, what's his name from ESPN? Tim Kirchin. This is like a Kirchin article of 1920. Just looking through the rosters and just it seems like an off-season article because it's just like so nonsensical. Oh, it mentions how both Ross Young, I thought they call him Young. I thought his name was Youngs. They mentioned that there's 2 Youngs, Ross Youngs and R. Stewart Young, who both have the nickname of Pep. So there you go. They mentioned Lee McGee and Sherwood McGee as 2 guys with the same name who were on the same team previously. A year ago, the Cincinnati box score specified between L. McGee and S. McGee.
What was the paper was this in again?
Good question. I printed out the headline and the article, but I didn't make a note of the paper.
Because I wonder, we got to figure out this journalist. We'll have to...
Yeah, follow what kind of weird writing.
Yeah, he seems to be kind of a gnar obsessed. So
yeah, he definitely is into the like, sort of the quirky side of the game and the looking at the name. So yeah, he was like our spiritual brethren from 100 years ago. And also, we found that other Bingles and Bungles article that mentioned how Babe Ruth should bunt, which I thought was so funny because you always hear guys saying now that you should bunt to beat the shift. And he said if Ruth bunted, he could probably get a home run because everyone would be so shocked that they would just stare at the ball and he could circle the bases. But I don't know if they shifted on Ruth or they just played real deep, you know? They probably just played they probably did some modified version of shifting to they knew where he was gonna hit it and it wasn't gonna be in the infield. So it was funny to read that writer. So yeah, lots of interesting stuff. Everything that you, every day you pick up a paper, look at the 1920 sports writing. There's always something good, and there's so many characters. And we'll do Turkey Day. We're gonna make Turkey Day a national holiday. That's a good idea. We'll look up some more other player profiles as the offseason goes on, and we'll look at some of the offseason maneuverings too, because there were some very interesting offseason. I mean, I admit I don't get quite as excited by the off the field stuff as I do the on field action, but there was like all with Landis coming in and with the leagues sort of being restructured a little bit in the 1920 off season. What was the name of that again that we were reading about?
The Lasker plan.
Yeah. The Lasker plan.
So yeah, definitely. And I think that ends up leading to Landis's appointment, but there's a lot there that we have to dig through. And admittedly, it's a lot of it's above my head. It's like these business talk, but.
Right. But it could have been very different. The league could have ended up in a very different way. So this is like a real critical time. So it's definitely a turning point for Major League Baseball right here after the 1920 season. And of course, every day new information comes out about the Black Sox. So we'll pick up with those stories as well. So thank you for introducing us to Cristobal Torriente. And I hope you enjoyed learning about Chubby Chester, the Golden West receiver.
Pinch Thomas. I love him.
Yeah, he's already in the 1920s baseball podcast Hall of Fame, if not the actual Hall of Fame, where Cristobal is and deserves to be. All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Check us out on Twitter at 1920s Baseball. If you have any questions, you can shoot them to us there. I'd love to hear from you. And check us out next time on This Week in 1920s Baseball.
Later.
Later.